Welcome to Betrayal Recovery Radio, the official podcast of APSATS, the Association of Partners of Sex Addict Trauma Specialists, hosted by Dr. Jake Porter. APSATS is a nonprofit organization providing professional training and compassionate support to partners affected by problematic sexual behavior and betrayal trauma. In each episode, Dr. Jake guides a conversation of enlightening insights and practical tools to empower those affected by sex addiction and betrayal trauma to use their voices and live their values. The mission of Betrayal Recovery Radio is to offer hope to those in need of healing and growth to those moving through grief. And now, here's your host, Dr. Jake Porter.
Welcome to another episode of Betrayal Recovery Radio. I am your host, Dr. Jake Porter. And in this episode, we are going to explore the Betrayal Trauma Religious Leader Training, a program that is offered by APSATS for faith leaders to work within their religious and faith-based communities. Our interview with Barb Steffens and Aviva Cole, the two trainers of the program, will uncover the core of this training, focusing on the APSATS multidimensional partner trauma model. Those who attend the Betrayal Trauma Religious Leader Training learn to provide response, assessment, and support to those experiencing betrayal trauma, incorporating their faith into the approach. It's a four-day training supplemented with mentor groups, and it equips participants with the skills needed to serve their religious community, emphasizing empathy and understanding, and enabling various religious organizations, nonprofits, and clinicians to address betrayal trauma within their specific faith settings. The two trainers who I'm interviewing today are no strangers to those who know the APSATS organization well. First, Barbara Steffens has provided mental health counseling and coaching in diverse settings for over 30 years. She specializes in helping women recover from sexual betrayal and is a sought-after speaker and presenter on special issues related to partners of sex addicts. She served as the founding president of the Association for Partners of Sex Addict Trauma Specialists from 2012 until she retired from that position in February of 2019, and much more recently this year, retired from her counseling practice as well. Aviva Cole is a board member of APSATS and has been a psychotherapist for over 30 years and has focused on partners and couples impacted by betrayal for over 10 years. In addition to being APSATS certified, she's also trained in various modalities, including IRCAM, narrative exposure therapy, and ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. Her past experience teaching Jewish philosophy makes her well-equipped to help clients navigate the intersection between psychology and religion. She has a special interest in increasing awareness about the traumatic impact of betrayal from problematic sexual behavior on couples and families within the Jewish community. Before we jump into this conversation, I do want to be sure and let you know about some of the things that APSATS is offering coming up here. September the 1st, Kim Hansen-Petroni and her one-hour workshop on the partner's role in couple work. Followed later in the month of September, the 28th through the 29th, Jessica Edens presenting her training on betrayed families, support for children and families. Then in October, Restoring Truth with Dan Drake and Janice Cottle, their disclosure guide training will be back. And then two things I really want to make sure you know about and you don't miss as well. November 1st through 3rd, APSATS will host its annual conference. This will be online, live via Zoom. There will be offerings for those who are experiencing or have experienced betrayal trauma, as well as professionals who support those walking through betrayal trauma. And if you are a professional and this is an area of interest for you and you've never taken the multidimensional partner trauma model training, which is really the foundational training of APSATS, that is being offered again November 14th through 17th online. All of this information can be found at APSATS.org. That's APSATS.org. There you can get a full calendar of various trainings and events that are coming up. All right, without further ado, listen in as we talk about how betrayal trauma can affect religious communities and members of those communities, and how leaders of these religious and faith-based communities can come alongside those who've experienced betrayal trauma and be a source of help, healing, and support for them.
Well,
Well, welcome to Betrayal Recovery Radio. Thank you, Barb and Aviva, for being here. I'm so grateful to have you both on the podcast.
Yeah. We're excited, or at least I am.
Yes. And I'm excited to talk about this topic. I think it's one that's so important. It's near and dear to my heart, having been a religious leader for 13 years before going into professional counseling. So what I want to start with is I want to ask you to just tell us a little more about your backgrounds and what led you to want to be a part of this training for religious leaders. And I'm going to go in the order I see you on my screen here. So Barb, would you take that first?
Sure. Well, I have a long background, so I don't know what to include and what not to, but I've been a counselor for a very long time. I just retired from doing clinical work.
Congratulations.
I know, it feels very strange. And then life events happened, and I found myself really focusing on helping partners, people who are betrayed, and doing that clinically. I also had a nonprofit job before I went back to school and did research, and it was around trying to get in religious communities to help them start talking about sexual brokenness, pornography, betrayal, addiction, those kinds of things. And that was back in the 90s, and it was next to impossible as a woman and the topic to get in and to have those conversations. So I had a passion for it back then. Some of you may know that I did some research that helped change our field so that we now see that partners experience trauma upon discovery of hidden sexual secrets and deception and betrayal. And then I moved really full time into that kind of work and ended up being the founding president for APSATS. Just retired from that a few years ago. But the entire time I've had this passion to try to help religious leaders, those who work with people of religious faith, but in particular, those people that are leading their churches, their synagogues, how can they help in ways that don't add more harm and confusion to someone who's been betrayed? So that's my background in a nutshell. It's a passion. It's something that I believe now I have time and space and energy that's really where I want to focus.
Thank you, Barb. Yeah. Aviva.
Well, also have long history, starting with just getting my social work degree and working in the field. I'm gonna give my age here a little bit, but over 30 years ago, of course, I was, about 10 when I went.
Absolutely. That's what I was gonna say.
So originally I was working in Jewish organizations. I was working in a Jewish school. I actually moved to Israel, and I was working as a school guidance counselor for a college. I actually opened a private practice, also geared to working with American Jews who were studying abroad. So I was heavily involved in the Jewish religious community from a clinical perspective as a clinical social worker. And at the same time had a real passion for teaching Judaism. So there was this other side of me that was also going off and teaching Judaism in a university in Jerusalem. And my journey continued, left Israel and moved to California. In California, I was a director of a Jewish outreach organization. So kind of putting my professional clinical side a little bit on hold and moved even more so into Jewish education, Jewish outreach, working with families, doing a lot of teaching around marriage and families. Wow. And that was my focus for a bunch of years. And I specifically got into the realm of teaching about Jewish sexuality because it's its own little field. It's actually when a bride and groom are about to get married, there's actually a very specific field of training to train bride and groom teachers to work with brides and grooms before they get married to teach them about sexuality. So that was a specialty of mine. So I was heavily involved in teaching Judaism, but very specifically focused on things that were, you know, true to my heart, being a clinician, marriage, family, and sexuality. Moved back into the field when I moved to New York, and that was about 17 years ago. And I got back into the field much more professionally, and I started working in a clinic at first, just to get my feet wet back into the field. And ironically, because they knew I had a lot of background in family work, they kind of gave me all the cases that were marriage and family issues. And lo and behold, everything that was landing at my door was some sort of betrayal issue. So whether it was full-blown sex addiction or it was, you know, one-time infidelity betrayal, it just kept on coming to me. So that kind of got me started into looking into what is the right way to deal with this. And I made a lot of mistakes along the way. And I think about those mistakes and I wonder where those clients are. And I pray for them, yes. But I made some mistakes until I found Barbara's book. And it was literally at the perfect time because at this point I was creating my own little kind of essay of thoughts about what I thought was missing in, you know, the kind of trainings out there, regular marriage therapy approaches that just weren't seeming to do the trick. So Barb's book was literally a life changer for me. And I got in touch with her and I learned a boatload from her. And that got me into the whole AppSets world. And I got trained, certified, got on the board. And then the passion continued into this next level, which is how do we help our faith communities to really be equipped to help these couples? Because this is not just any mental health illness that can just go to see a clinician and get the help they need in the four walls of a clinician's office, because it's a real community issue. At least this is what I find, and I know from my experiences with, you know, speaking to Barb and a lot of other colleagues out there in other faith communities, it is a community issue. It is,
yes, it is for sure.
It's not like any other mental illness, and it needs more support.
Yeah, thank you so much, Aviva. And I, you know, where I want to go next is, it may seem like we're going backwards or starting, I don't know, at too basic a level. But my vision, my hope for this conversation we're having is that it might be the first thing that some religious leaders hear on this subject. So I want to start with just laying a foundation. What is betrayal trauma? What is betrayal trauma? And why is it particularly significant within a faith community or religious context to understand what betrayal trauma is? Barb, do you want to take that first?
Sure, I can. Oh, goodness. So most of us understand what trauma is. Trauma is something that happens to us. It invades our world. It can take a lot of different forms. And betrayal trauma is a very specific kind. So it requires a relationship where there's some kind of dependency or interdependency where we rely on each other. It's a close relationship. I'm not betrayed by a stranger. I'm betrayed by someone who knows me and who I have extended some level of trust. Or let's say if I'm a child, I have to trust because my whole welfare and being relies on this adult who's taking care of me. But when we're talking about betrayal trauma, we're talking about adults in our field who have made some kind of commitment to one another. And there's an expectation of safety and honesty and the ability to give consent about what's going to happen in the relationship. And so betrayal trauma occurs when those things are violated. So someone is hiding their sexual behaviors, doing things that are against the agreement that occurred in the relationship about how we were going to be. And it's an invasion kind of feeling. Like I had this feeling of what my relationship was like. There's an event or a discovery, and now all of a sudden I realize I've been betrayed or someone has been betraying me. And so it looks like other kinds of trauma, but it's more complicated because usually we are still in a relationship with that person who betrayed us and traumatized us. So the trauma can continue a longer period of time than it would, let's say, if it was a stranger who did something and assaulted me and then disappears. Now the person who betrayed me is still here, and I am probably still with them and still trying to figure out what in the world just happened. How did this happen? Am I responsible? Are they responsible? And so it's that the part of the relationship and kind of the interdependence in the relationship, I think, that makes it even more complicated than what we would think of like a traumatic event. It's an ongoing event that continues.
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Barbara. And and Aviva, can you speak to why do you think it's so important in a religious context, in a faith community, that this concept is known, particularly by the leaders?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, like I said, any other mental illness, it's super important, I think, for religious leaders to be educated about it, anything and everything. But this one in particular, it is so sensitive, and it touches so many different aspects of Jewish life, of religious life, of community life. You're talking about decisions that have to be made that obviously will include the possibility of divorce, and that, of course, is a can of worms. Divorce is permissible. In Judaism, there's an entire tractate called Divorce, lots and lots of pages in the Talmud. So it's absolutely permissible, but it is, of course, discouraged. You know, there's a saying in the Talmud that the altar cries when a man divorces a woman. And yeah, and it's, of course, you know, something that we all mourn. And it's not something that we ever go to as it's not the first go to. And we believe you try everything. So given that very important value in our community, I think that this kind of a trauma, it's complicated, and it is something that necessitates more than just a therapist, a coach, right? Because these individuals, they go and they seek religious leadership for big decisions like that, all right? They're going to go to the leader and say, I don't want to make the altar cry. Is this really the right thing to do? And then there's, of course, even just the community repercussions. It's really hard to be divorced in the Jewish Orthodox community. We're an incredibly close-knit community, very family-oriented. We're all living like sardines because we can't drive cars, so we need to be really walking distance to our synagogues on Shabbat. It makes for a real beautiful community feeling. And when someone's going through something like this in the middle of a close-knit community where everyone sees everyone and knows what's going on in everyone's lives, for someone to get divorced and to get divorced around an issue like this, this stigma. So there's so much at stake and so much of an impact for a partner who discovers betrayal in terms of making decisions. And they go to their religious leaders, not just rabbis. There are a lot of religious leaders with different roles, but they're going to seek their advice. These are big issues. I could go on and on and on because there's lots of reasons why. And there's legal issues. There are real legal questions that come up that the clinician can answer. I am working constantly in tandem with rabbis. I have rabbis join my sessions. Mm-hmm. I'm constantly consulting. My clients are consulting. And we kind of have to be a team. So they need to know what are the facts on the ground, because it's going to affect what their decision is going to be, you know, based on what's the science. Yeah. Yes. So it's just, there's a lot of pieces why this is super important.
Thank you.
For the community.
Yeah. Go ahead, Barb. It looks like you've got a thought as well.
I wanted to add just a little bit. You know, Aviva is doing a really good job talking about the Jewish community and the training that those rabbis have. In a lot of our more Christian communities, there's limited training perhaps on what is trauma and how do you respond to trauma. Sometimes people will like over-spiritualize something, and so they're giving spiritual answers rather than being trauma-informed to be able to be with an individual who comes to you in great pain. So part of our training is really helping people know how to be with for a period of time and really understanding and appreciating the pain. Because if a faith leader can't be with, then it's going to be really hard for someone else to receive some information from them. They're going to feel dismissed. I hear from partners all the time that, you know, they tried to go to their pastor, let's say in a Christian faith, and they were given a few Bible verses to read and then sent on. Or, you can't divorce, so you just need to forgive and get over this. He said he's sorry, so move on. And so they're given kind of superficial responses and support. And so we want to make sure that they're getting a depth of support when they do go to their faith communities. Also, I think it's important for a faith leader to know what they should not be doing. You know,
thank you.
If they're not trained therapists, counselors, coaches, then don't enter into that process, but know who is around you who are informed. So part of our training is helping them know what are my lanes, you know, where do I stay? What is my specific role? And then how do I encourage people to move on to individuals who do have more training and expertise on how to help? So it's what to do and also what not to do.
Yeah, I think that's so crucial. And just to sort of pull together what you've both shared with some of my own experience back when I was pastoring a church, you know, I know it's true that pastors are often on the front lines, right? Mm-hmm. Crisis happens, or a rabbi, religious leaders, those people who are standing in front, sort of representing someone's faith system, which is such a cornerstone of identity for so many people, right? And so when crisis happens, they go to that person, often first. Yeah. And, you know, Aviva, when you were talking earlier about looking back at clients you had early on when you didn't know some of these things, I was nodding my head, remembering some of my early experiences as a pastor when some couples, some wives or husbands would come to me in distress. And I'm not going to be careful because it's my experience and people who are listening can identify with this or not. But I look back now and I see that there was a presumption I had that bordered on an arrogance that, well, I'm the faith leader. I'm the expert in these very important things. And so, of course, I should be giving direction here. Mm-hmm. And I will just say that I'm grateful that before I left that position, I'd taken the APSATS training. I had started doing clinical work as well and was able to right some of those errors that I had made earlier on.
Yeah. And we're grateful for the first responder role of the faith leader.
Yes.
Absolutely. But we just want to encourage them to know, after you do this first responder role, and how do you do this first responder role, then what's next as well? And we want to be resources for that.
Yes.
And some of those resources obviously would be who to refer to, the trained coaches and clinicians that can actually walk these individuals through their healing. that's definitely one piece. But then there's a role, I think, a really important role of support that's very specific. Yeah. It's not the clinical treatment, but it is support. And I have found it to be crucial.
Yeah. Yes.
Crucial for many.
Yes. Yeah. Because one of the things that I've heard from clients, and this is an error that I'm sure I know that I also committed back in my pastoring days. So the pendulum could swing in the other direction as well, right? So you could have the leader who is thinking, well, I'm going to run point on this because I'm the expert. But you could also have the one that makes the referral and then never follows up, never ask how they're doing, is afraid to speak of it, right? Is completely hands off at that point. And what I'm hearing you say is that there's a real need, not, yes, that front person, that front lines person is so crucial, but there's a continued role for these religious leaders to play for those who are walking through betrayal trauma. And I'm just going to add, not just for the one betrayed, but the one who did the betraying as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah. So what does that look like? What does that ongoing support role look like for a religious leader?
You want to answer, Barb?
It can be a variety of things. It could be just checking in. Hey, I made this referral. Wanted to see if you were able to connect. How are you doing? How can I be praying for you? Whatever those things are. But it's showing, yes, you're still on my mind. I do care. And I want to know, are things moving forward? A more, systemic way of responding too would be being one of those faith communities that's willing to sponsor or to open up space for support groups, things like that, that people can, and then you can refer in your community and you can know that it's a safe place. Also, I think another way of following up is asking, your person who's in your community, what are you learning? And what do you think might be helpful for me to know that would help me for the next person? So wanting to get feedback and some education for themselves as well. But I think the main thing is just that this is not something that you have to stay quiet about in this community. This is something you can talk to me about or other people. And I just had this thought. Another thing for a faith leader to do would be to help educate your whole community on how are we safe people with each other so that this is a safe place to struggle and to be in pain rather than a place where I have to come and put my happy face on and pretend nothing bad just happened. There's a whole lot there, Jake. I could talk forever.
That's huge. I can feel myself getting emotional thinking about this. Yeah. I was a pastor when I got into recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I remember being told by a very wonderful Christian therapist, CSAT, who I went to originally, like, you're going to go to a 12-step meeting. And I thought, why do I need to go to a 12-step meeting? I have God, I've got my faith, or I've got this or that. And I remember going and being blown away by the safety that I experienced in those rooms where I could share anything. It wasn't excused. It wasn't swept under the rug. It wasn't minimized. It was taken seriously. But I was also met with absolute grace and acceptance. And I remember thinking, why does this not exist in my church experience, in my faith community experience? It was a huge moment for me. And what a vision if religious leaders could, humbly say, we need to grow here. We need to learn how to be a safe place.
And I would say that if a faith community starts doing that, then the people that are struggling or who have gone through betrayal trauma, who are struggling with their sexual behaviors, are going to have a sense of this is an okay place for me to bring this up and get some additional support. But if we don't talk about it and if we're not engaging in intentionality and being safe community, there's a lot of hurting people that come. And Absolutely. We don't know it because they don't feel safe enough to bring it up. So we want to mm-hmm. help faith communities, faith leaders know, how do you set up such a community to be that kind of safe place? How do you respond when there's this kind of crisis among your people? Because how you respond yes. isn't just for this client or this person, this not a client, but this person that's in your community. The other people will be watching to see how are you responding to this couple that just went through this.
Yes.
And yeah, I think you're making such a good point. It's not just about the specific response that this leader shows to this specific couple or individual, because those leaders, they're being watched mm-hmm. and they're role models. And if this is the message that they're giving to the community, then others will follow their lead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's why it is so important to go up to the leadership to give the messages yeah. down to the people about how to respond. And I think destigmatizing this mm-hmm. is the number one
yeah.
thing that has to happen. And I could tell you that, I mean, I've been trying to do this grassroots for the past few years, and I am so excited that this is happening in such a formalized, structured way with such unbelievable people like you guys through APSATS. But the grassroots that I was doing meant, you know, me calling up these rabbis and driving up to their bungalow colonies and getting an hour and a half with them with their grandchildren running around, and I'm sitting there with my papers and showing them this and that, and look at the Jake Porter thing here, at the Barbara Steffens, and it's been unbelievable. The you know, just that was destigmatizing, that I'm walking in to talk to an incredibly prominent rabbi about these issues, about sexuality, about betrayal trauma, and he was open to it. He invited me to hear wow. what I had to say. And I've, you know, it's been a process, and I'm slowly but surely getting this out there. I had a table, APSATS had a table at the Jewish Mental Health Conference, the Nefesh Conference,
Wonderful.
Which is huge mental yeah. health conference for the Jewish people. And it was like, you know, it was a little bit, you know, a little bit shocking, I think, to some. I had some comments. People were like, it says sex on this thing. You know, we were giving out the little COVID time. We were giving out the, you know, hand sanitizer, and it said sex. I don't know if I could bring this back to my office, you know. And
wow.
You know, a big banner that had the word sex on it. And these rabbis with long beards passing right by, coming right over to my table. No problem. Tell me, what is this? Let Very me understand. Cool.
Wow. So
it's happening. It's happening. It's slow. And I'm sure I'm going to, you know, it's going to be an uphill battle, but yeah. I'm hoping to get an army with me, and you guys are my generals, and we're going to get the word out there, and hopefully it'll, you know, kind of trickle down to the masses. And I think that's why we got to go to the leadership first.
Yeah. I love that, Aviva. I love that story. I want to talk about the role, the potential role that faith can play in healing from betrayal trauma. But before we go there, I want to actually bring up sort of the misuse of faith. And you've both alluded to this. We haven't used the phrase yet, but I want to talk about spiritual bypass. Mm-hmm. Because I think there are probably a lot of religious leaders that maybe have never heard of that. I know that in my time in that role, I don't think I knew what spiritual bypass was. So, Barb, I'm going to throw that one to you first. Okay. You know, will you talk about what spiritual bypass is? Let's just start there.
Okay. Well, this was a new concept for me, although I saw it, I just didn't have words to describe it.
Right.
There's research
yes.
on spiritual bypass. So it's really using spiritual writings, spiritual disciplines, any kind of spiritual material, which is all good stuff, but using it to bypass or jump over the emotions, the pain, the process. So that can be an individual who has been wounded, and they're just going to keep saying, well, I'm just going to pray and I'm going to believe. And they're saying all these things to try to avoid the painfulness. Or a faith leader may say, well, just make sure that you are reading your Bible every day and you are praying and you're doing all these things. And if you're still angry, then you must still be in sin. And so making judgments about emotions rather than allowing for the pain and the lament, the grief, the anger, the emotions that are there. But spiritual bypass is trying to jump over all that stuff, get to the other side, right, kind of clean yourself up. But it's using the spiritual disciplines or spiritual teachings to numb out the emotions or the behaviors.
Yes.
It's avoidance. Yeah.
Which is so interesting, right? Because like in the Christian scripture, Jewish scripture, you know, the book of Psalms is huge.
It's huge.
It's all emotion. It's all about emotion, right? And I think it would be naive to think, you know, David sat down and in the time he wrote down those words, worked through all those emotions. I would bet that was a reflective process of writing of something that probably took quite some time to work through those emotions. And
you see it throughout. There's ups and the downs. Yeah. He goes up, he goes down, it's a problem.
That's right. It's not a perfect incline toward healing. And well, that was a judgment in the way I phrased that. It's not a straight shot. How about that?
Yeah.
Right. So I think it's huge. And, you know, I was just in my own reading the other day, you know, there's a passage about there's two passages that are very similar. One is if you remember that your brother has something against you, you know, before you go to the altar, you go and make it right. But then it's also the flip side. If you have something against your brother, you go and make it right before you present your gift. And I thought that's spiritual bypass, right? Because the people who think, well, in the Christian world, maybe the language is, I'm just going to lay it at the feet of Jesus or lay it at the cross or whatever, right? Thinking I can just go do this. No, you have to deal with what's happened in this relationship first. So what role, you know, so we don't want to do that. So how can faith, though, play a part in healing from betrayal trauma? And I'm thinking here about the multidimensional partner trauma model and the three phases. And I don't want to tell y'all how to answer, but in my mind, even as I'm asking, I'm imagining how faith can inform all three of those phases. So I want to give you both an opportunity to just kind of riff on that. What role can faith play in healing from betrayal?
You want to go with that, Aviva?
You want to hear like a blow? Sure.
Let's do it.
Just start.
We'll see where we go.
I'll give it a shot. Okay, so definitely the first phase is where religious leaders come in sometimes before we do, right? They'll end up at their door before they come to me, and I usually get referrals from religious leaders. But that means that they're falling apart on their door. So first phase, if they take the training and they are equipped, I would imagine, I would hope that they would do the R of our, we have a little acronym. Can we tell a little acronym? Are we giving a little teaser for the training?
I think teaser sounds wonderful.
Yes, do it.
The acronym is RARES.
Okay.
I like it. This helps me remember.
Yeah.
RES. So the first thing is respond. So we hope to equip religious leaders to respond appropriately as a religious leader. And that's going to be, they're bleeding out. They are bleeding out on your doorstep. So what do you do? What don't you do? Right?
Yeah. Because
you don't start asking them about their arthritis in their knee. They're bleeding out in their gut. You say, sit down and you start closing up that wound. And
just to make it clear, Aviva, just to add to what you're saying, for those who may not know, so that, because that first phase is really all about safety and stabilization. I just want to put that out there. So keep going.
Safety and stabilization phase means crisis shows up at your door. What do you got to do? You got to stabilize. You got to bring safety. So she's bleeding. You got to help that bleeding to stop. Validate, empathize, understanding betrayal trauma, right? Having that knowledge after, you know, going through the training, they will be able to see it differently, because otherwise it might have been hard to see it that way, right? They'll, you know, see a couple coming in and they'll hear, yeah, he was, you know, doing this problematic sexual behavior and she's screaming and yelling. And, you know, it might look a little messy and it might look like, oh, she looks a little bit borderline. And okay, I know what he did, but maybe he was just, you know, I don't know. One time, two times, what did he do already? That might have been pre the training, a religious leader's perspective, because it's true. It's true. She is screaming and yelling, and it's true. So he slipped. Okay. And in normal circumstances, in normal marriage issues, if there is a slip up and the wife has a reaction, yeah, I would understand a rabbi sitting the couple down and talking to them in a specific way. But not when it comes to this. This is not just, he didn't go to synagogue like this morning or for the last 3 weeks. That's not what this is. So it's a crisis. She's bleeding. It's trauma. Understand what's going on in her brain. Understand her reactions. They're normal. Validate the heck out of her. Empathize. While, of course, it's a real balancing act for a religious leader who also has, you know, the husband coming in usually at the same time, but holding him, knowing that he's probably got a boatload of shame, and learning about that enough to know that the way to deal with that shame is not to cover it up by turning to the partner and blaming her and pathologizing her or excusing him or treating him with kid gloves, but rather to just open up to the piece that she needs, empathize, validate, teach him that what his role right now in repair is going to be, when and if he's ready, to join a role model, you know, for him, how to empathize and validate. That to me would be, you know, first phase, safety and stabilization. And then, of course, educating. What are the possible ways of getting through this? And someone who's gone through the training would know there are specialized clinicians, coaches that could walk you through it. There's a process. There's a beginning phase, a middle phase, an end phase. And there's, you know, tools, there's disclosure, there's boundaries, there's therapeutic separation. If the crisis that's landing on your door is insane, you know, suggesting things like that, in-house separation. So I could see these being suggestions with the knowledge to kind of get things calm. And then give them a GPS of where are you going to go from here? That does that make sense? I think than a rabbi could do within a, you know, a 5-hour crisis intervention.
Sure. So that first phase is safety and stabilization. The second phase then, and this can take weeks, months, you know, and depending upon a host of other factors, it could take years if there's, you know, but hopefully they get some good help and support. Safety and stabilization is in place. And then that second phase is around remembrance, mourning, and meaning-making. Barbara, could you speak to maybe where faith can play a role in that phase?
I keep having this memory of how a pastor responded to me. And at the time, I didn't like it. But he invited me to write my own psalm around what I was feeling and experiencing. Wow. So entering into that process of grieving, of remembering, of writing it down, but that the goal was not only that I was writing this down, but then I was taking that to God. And so it was encouraging me to get my support all different places, but to find out, where is God in this for me? And what do I need to say to him? In my anger, in my sadness, to facilitate that relationship between me and the Lord, me and God, as well as providing a safe place, being there while I cry or while I'm grieving, but to leave space for that. And so many, I don't know what it's like in the Jewish community, Aviva, in the Christian community, sometimes we are just happy all the time. All the time. And we don't have a lot of space for anything else. And so a safe community for someone going through this is allowing for lament, is allowing for grief, and allowing for space for that and processes for that. So I think faith can be really, really healing as someone is going through that. And a faith leader or someone who is in the faith community who can be with someone as they remember and as they mourn, that's a gift.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you.
I would take on that, you know, the role that they could play while, let's say, their therapist is promoting the grief work. And, you know, they just went to an amazing intensive with Jake Porter, and he's all about that, you know, mourning and grief work. And they come back, and then they're like, yeah, but what, why isn't she getting out of it yet? Like, can we move on? We did the grief stuff. We did all these nice little exercises.
Get over it.
And get over it already. Starts showing up.
Anyone who says that hasn't been to an intensive with me.
That's right.
I'm kidding. No, but go on, Aviva. You're making that. This is a good point.
So
keep
this
going.
Is where I think, again, of course, you know, as a clinician, I can hold space for that and try to bring him back in and help him again to understand the depths and levels and time and space that a partner needs to grieve and how it's going to look. And it might have moments where it looks like she's crawling out and moments where she's back in. But what I think a faith leader could add to the mix here is take the guys out. And I have one case of this where there's a rabbi in a community in Connecticut who's been unbelievable. Mm. He did training. He did the upsets training. And he takes these guys out. Usually it's like over the weekend, Saturday night. And he sits with them and he talks to them about what was hard this week. In trying to help your partner to grieve and hearing her pain, and how can you continue to be that source of helping her heal? So that to me again is like it would be in my mind like a template for what a community support person could do if he could be that support for these guys to help them through what's really hard as the partner is healing. So you can get it up here intellectually. Right. They can go to a great, you know, workshop and then they can come back and then it's hard. And in between sessions with a therapist, having these support people out in the community that get it is so, so important.
Oh, that's great.
That's what I'm hoping.
That's wonderful. Okay. And then that final phase is about renewal and post-traumatic growth and looking forward and sort of revisioning themselves and the relationship. So How about during that phase? How can faith play a role in healing there?
I think the first thing that comes to mind is just the community of faith. Hopefully that's been there the entire time, but that community of faith can encourage growth, can give space for that, can help people move into the next area where they feel themselves going. So I think it's just that continuum, but also understanding that during this process, sometimes people's faith changes a little bit. There may be some things that they always believed that now they're going, wait a minute, that didn't really help me during this time, or I haven't figured out where does it fit with this. And so part of, you know, traumatic growth may be saying some of this stuff that I believe to be true, now I'm wondering, how is it true for me and what does it look like for me? So a faith community allowing space for someone to wrestle with, you know, where am I now in my belief system, or how have I grown in my belief? What am I questioning? Leave space for that as someone is, you know, moving forward and envisioning their future. I haven't met anyone yet who comes out on the other side, however long that process is, which is years, the same person. And I don't think that happens when we're traumatized. Part of traumatic growth is we learn new things and we grow and allow for growing in our faith as well, what that looks like yes. for us. So that's what comes to mind for me first for the faith community.
Yeah. Thank you. So, thank you.
I was going to hear that and the little details that I might add that might be more detailed things that could happen in that phase. If there are those individuals that at that point do decide to either have a therapeutic separation or at that point divorce, there's a huge amount of support that's needed from the religious communities. Yeah. And it's kind of where I'm out, you know, like I help them to that point, maybe they'll come back to me. And I do have those that come back and want, you know, in their new post-traumatic growth phase, they want to do some more clinical work, but it's kind of that interim, like, all right, you got me here. I made my decision. And then they need their community people to walk them through the changes of what life is going to be like as a divorced single mother in a community where that's not so common and it's getting more common, unfortunately. But that's where I think there's a tremendous need for support. And again, specifically about this, because there's stigma around it. You know, if people know and do they know and what happened, and, you know, especially if there are changes that are obvious, sometimes there are changes that are obvious and then everyone's talking, and they need the support of the community to, for the children to feel normalized, and for the partners to be accepted fully and embraced. So I think there's a lot of work for religious leaders in that phase. And also the sexuality is in that phase. The reintegration of sexuality is in that phase. So I think a lot of issues come up in terms of Jewish law. A lot of questions come to the rabbis at this point, you know, to be intimate, not to be intimate, how? And there are different ramifications, you know, birth control. There's a lot of different issues that come up in that phase that we really do need leadership to have an understanding of what this reality is. Yeah.
Mm, thank you.
Just my little addition.
So hopefully some of the folks listening, any religious leaders listening are thinking, yeah, this sounds like something I need. So tell them just a little bit about the logistics of the training, the length, you know, how it's offered, the format, that kind of stuff.
Okay. Well, I can jump in on that.
Sure.
There are a few different ways that people can do this. One way is APSATS is going to offer a yearly training where people who want this training sign up through the APSATS website and they can go to that date. I don't think we have a date set yet for that for next year, but we will soon. So that's just in general. You go to the APSATS website and you find the information and you sign up. The one that I get the most excited about is if someone really wants this training and they're part of a larger organization, then we work with you to determine what kind of thing is going to be helpful for you. We can do like 2 days to 4 days, but to really try to tailor it to your unique organization. We just did one for a very large organization, and it was amazing. And so it touched people. It's an online organization, so it touched people all over the United States and probably some other countries. But again, we tailored a lot of what we did based on what their needs are. And then the third way would be if there's maybe, you know, 5 people over here and 10 people over here, different organizations, we could pull you together and do a joint one, again, based on what your needs are. So we really want to be responsive to what the organization needs and see if we can make it work. And the main thing is we have to have at least 20 people to do the training. So we have to have that.
And Barb, if someone's interested in going that route, how would they initiate that process? Who would they contact?
Well, they would go through the website and there should be a contact there, or they can always just email info@apsats.org, and that person who responds to that email will know how to direct it either to me or to other people on our team.
Oh, wonderful. That's so exciting. Well, as we close, I want to give you both an opportunity to just, you know, give any final words of encouragement and wisdom on this subject to those who are listening. Aviva, you want to go first?
Encouragement. I guess the words of encouragement I would want to give is anyone out there like myself who has been in a position of leadership within a Jewish organization and is a clinician, if you are feeling similar to the way I've been feeling, the way Barb described feeling, and you want to get out there and make some changes because you see that there has been already an excitement and there has been changes, I want to give you that hope that I've seen it, and it's slow, but I'm getting a lot of positive feedback. So I want to encourage you to walk in my footsteps, join me, hold my hand, and let's create a team, because I think it's going to be teamwork that's going to really help move this forward even more. And I want to say that I've seen miracles.
Thank you. If
that could be encouraging, I'm not saying it isn't hard. And I think I have one testimonial on my website where someone was like really honest, brutally honest, but really good. Like there were miracles, something along those lines of like how much his marriage like has grown. And he was so thankful, but he was clear. He goes, but it is hard.
Sure.
So that is the truth. But with that, I think with hard work, when you get the real results. The fruits. So I am encouraging anyone who wants to come and join us in our passionate mission.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Reach out.
Thank you so much. And Barb?
Well, Aviva just said, join us. And to me, that says you are not alone. Sometimes people that are faith leaders, again, I know my Christian faith communities, and a lot of times it can feel a whole lot of pressure for the staff, for the pastor, for the minister. And we know that you are already doing all sorts of wonderful things that you've been tasked to do. And we don't want to give you one more thing you have to do. We want to give you some equipment that you can use as you are doing what you're called to do, just so that you do it better, but also so that you know you're not alone in it. So if you go through a training with us, it's not like, okay, you're done. See ya. We do mentorship with you on what does this mean for you, for your community? How are you wanting to then spread this information out? Or what else might you need that we can help resource for you? So we don't want to just give you information and say, bye, do this. We want to join with you. We want to help you do this. And we want to thank you for being willing to think about doing this. And if you're just even thinking about it, just give one of us a call and we'll help you.
Yeah.
We'll talk through it with you.
Yes.
That is really, really a beautiful approach, because that's the truth. Because we need the community to do it. Yeah. I was calling out for them to come and help us. We need it and they need it. And we know that, because we were out there in the trenches and some of us making mistakes. I don't believe you made too many mistakes, Jake, but I did.
Oh, yeah.
So I know that there are those out there that need it. And I think that we want to help you. Yeah. Yes. So I think that was what you were saying.
Let us know how we can help.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Barb and Aviva. You are both just special people. Thank you for answering this calling. Thank you for putting yourself out there and doing this work. I know that countless numbers of people are being helped and finding healing as a result. So thank you for being here.
Thanks, Jake.
Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of Betrayal Recovery Radio, hosted by Dr. Jake Porter. If you value the content we've shared today, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review. This helps others find the show, and we greatly appreciate it. For more resources, visit APSATS.org. That's APSATS.org.